Imagine you are granted one of history's impossible honors. Despite his death 20 years ago, you're given the chance to have drinks with one of the most famous resistance, a founder of combat, the one and only Henri Frenet. You take your seat across from this great man and finally ask the question that's been burning in your mind for years. Monsieur Frenet, what the were you thinking? First, I want to apologize for the delay in getting this episode out. The first draft was written in October of last year, but something about it has been bothering me since then. After rewriting it, I figured out the problem. It's the subject. I don't want to talk about this man. There's so many good things to say, but they come with a lot of unpleasantness. The long, strange trip of Henri Frenet. Where to start? When Pétain assumed power in 1940, Monsieur Frenet was relieved. He was in a German POW camp at the time, and was convinced that if anyone could be counted on to oust the Germans, it would be the hero of Verdun. He escaped the camp in July 1940 as organized resistance was just starting. He committed himself to fighting the Germans by writing a personal manifesto, one of the first written declarations of resistance. He soon founded the National Liberation Movement and started putting out a newspaper, Vérité's. Both would later be merged with François de Menthon's work with Liberté to form the network and newspaper known as Combat. If the name Combat doesn't sound familiar to you yet, commit it to memory now. It was one of, if not the, largest individual resistance network in the whole of the occupation. Their underground newspaper reached a circulation of between 250 to 300,000, and it was edited by Albert Camus. If you remember only one network's name, remember Combat. Monsieur Frenet ate, slept, and breathed combat, and why wouldn't he? It was an awesome group. As far as one could tell, there was only one problem. Combat was not the whole of the resistance. Yet Monsieur Frenet seems to have had trouble drawing lines between these three entities. Combat, the resistance, and himself. You know how some movies are presented with a name above the title? William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet? James Cameron's Avatar? It seems at times as if Monsieur Frenet thought of it as Henri Frenet's The Resistance. At least this was how he presented himself to American officials of the OSS in the Swiss affair, but more on that later. General de Gaulle, though a focal point of the resistance, wasn't necessarily its leader. Many people, including Frenet himself, still believed Pétain was playing a double game. Those people needed to be convinced that the only viable, national, Allied-funded resistance would be Gaullist. The man who came to do the convincing was the man whose name has pushed Frenet's off more statues and perhaps over more edges than any other, Jean Moulin. Between them, they fought the battle that more than any other determined the political fate of post-war France, the Battle of the CNR. For the record, I wasn't going to throw down Mr. Moulin's name until he got his own episode, perhaps his own two or three episodes. But you cannot talk about Henri Frenet without mentioning his bane, his nemesis, his boss. Intellectually, Frenet understood that the resistance needed outside support, but for a man who may have secretly seen it as his resistance, this meant taking a huge humble. Not only would his underground papers have to switch their allegiance to a general his hero Pétain had declared a traitor, it meant Frenet would have to take instruction from de Gaulle's man on the ground in France. This was nearly de Gaulle's bridge too far. If Henri Frenet sounded like an unqualified hero back there for a while, well, you're right, he is. But the man is also a riddle wrapped in an enigma covered in Rubik's Cube dots. Combat under his leadership had a tendency to be very combative, and not just against the Germans. Henri Frenet held frequent, loud arguments about how wrong it was that when the Allied funds for the resistance were cut, that meant combat too. He hated the fact de Gaulle's men in France wasn't him, which was a bit of a stretch since, arguably, he hated de Gaulle. He once tried to get de Gaulle to fire Mr. Moulins on the grounds of, wait for it, doing too good a job of administering de Gaulle's own instructions. Modern American parlance has a term for this sort of move. Oh no, you didn't! Not that he's too good at his job is exactly how Monsieur Frenet made his case. His argument was that Milan got in his way too much, but that came about through enforcing de Gaulle's own instructions. De Gaulle being the man Frenet was making the complaint to in the first place. I know it sounds weird, but really, have you ever met a fascist who didn't have a dissociative disorder? That's right, I dropped the F-bomb. Monsieur Frenet, hero of the resistance, believed that while the Germans were no good, this whole wipe-out democracy idea merited some consideration. He and others argued that if having political parties was such a great idea, how come they'd been invaded in the first place? To be fair to Monsieur Frenet, and one can certainly be fair to this gentleman without running out of things to talk about, I'm not sure he was technically a fascist. He just didn't think there should be communists, or radicals, or, you know, political parties of any kind. He wanted them all wiped out, but I'm not sure he was a fascist because I still don't know what he expected to replace them with. As resistance leader Colonel Passé once noted, Monsieur Frenet had, quote, a disconcerting habit of expressing contradictory ideas in rapid succession, end quote. From what I've read, and this is a bit hazy, it seems he wanted the resistance itself, fresh from defeating those freedom-hating Nazis, to rule the country as the one and only party. Had it worked out that way, it would have been a sad case of meet the new boss, same as the old boss. But there was no telling that to Monsieur Frenet, and we know because someone tried. Jean Milan would have made an excellent priest. And in a way, that's what he was. His father raised him in the family religion, freedom and France. A lifelong devotee to the rights of man, he never lost that zealous, just-converted fervor. He was a passionate advocate on behalf of things like the right of people to vote for the party of their choice, even if that meant sometimes fools and fascists won elections. That was his cause, and yell as he might, Monsieur Frenet could never quite win people over as well as his boss could. While the resistance wasn't quite a democracy, it wasn't quite anything else either. Adherents of both sides in any debate gathered support as best they could. The most strident debate of all was whether or not to give political parties seats on the governing body of the resistance, the CNR, the Council National de la Résistance. As the CNR was basically an Allied-backed in-country shadow government, its influence in post-liberation France would be unmatched and unstoppable. This made the Battle of the CNR the most decisive French battle of the war. In this battle, the tactics used by each side couldn't have been more different. While Frenet yelled, Milan soothed. While Frenet ordered, Milan politely but firmly insisted. While Milan engaged in passionate debate, Frenet declared war. He also lost. De Gaulle trusted Jean Milan like no other, and Milan was able to convince him that, shadow government or not, the CNR would have no moral authority if it didn't include a few groups that had, at some point, received the votes of the French people. Without them, and the trade unions that were also included, the CNR could not have claimed to speak for the people, but only for itself. And the CNR needed to speak for the people. Sharks were circling around de Gaulle by that time. The Americans were looking for any reason to replace him as presumed leader of the French people with someone else. Someone less spiky, less strident, less French. Despite the CNR's need to be seen as a representative, democratic institution, Monsieur Frenet carried on. And on and on. He may have declared war, but never defeat. He kept fighting his battle with Milan until well into the 1970s, when he released a book about his former boss, The Enigma of Jean Milan, in which he claimed he was a secret communist. Apparently it was so secret that not even Monsieur Milan nor the communists knew about it, as no credible evidence has ever backed up this claim. This despite the fact Monsieur Milan is one of the most heavily researched men in modern French history. Still, I can't quite bring myself to be angry with Monsieur Frenet for all of this. The man was stuck between a Jean Milan statue and a hard place. Not quite Jean Milan is almost our hero's unofficial tombstone. During the invasion, when he was writing his personal declaration against the Germans, his future boss was already being beaten and tortured by Nazis in an attempt to get him to sign false documents about the bombing of a local school. He never signed, attempting suicide instead. When Monsieur Fernet was planning what national liberation would do next week, Monsieur Milan was sketching out a report for London on what the resistance could be doing next year, given the proper support. While Fresnay seemed to advocate a the-resistance-will-work-something-out plan for post-war France, Milan organized a covert think tank to map out the post-liberation transition of powers. In a famous speech given on the occasion of Monsieur Milan's ashes being interred in the Pantheon in Paris, it was said, he didn't make any of the units. Instead, he made the army. Well, Fresnay did make the units, and he helped make the army. And being constantly asked to pass the ball so Milan could dunk was grating on him. At one point, while having lunch with de Gaulle at the Savoy in London, he tried to insist that if de Gaulle was going to keep Milan running things on the ground in France, then de Gaulle might have to do it without Fresnay. To which de Gaulle calmly replied, "In that case, France will have to choose between you and me." Note to posterity, never play chicken with de Gaulle. Not long after this, the Germans, in league with Vichy, occupied the so-called Free Zone in the south, where combat was based. With this move, even the most reluctant of Gaullists had to acknowledge on which side their bread was buttered. Or did they? I'd like to leave you with the impression Monsieur Fresnay was just a complicated hero, but I have to admit, that might not be the whole story. With the same determination he brought to fighting those others who claimed to be running things, the Germans, he set out to undermine the resistance leaders above him. In what's referred to as the Swiss Affair, he made trips to Bern to sell intelligence gathered by the resistance to American Alan Dulles. Dulles was part of the OSS at the time, later to become the CIA, and was representing an America that still had their fingers crossed for a change of caste. They had already been positioning potential replacements for de Gaulle, French generals Darlin and Girard. It is the act of a traitor to sell out military intelligence to the enemy. But America was an ally, and the money was funneled back into the resistance, which was only kind of a military to begin with. There was no tribunal for this sort of thing, and the only people you could get to jury it would be Fresnay's inferiors. So what sort of options do you have for dealing with this kind of betrayal? If there's one thing people viewing this entanglement may be able to agree on, it's that the Swiss Affair is a classic example of what happens when a grassroots organization must accept top-down administration. Monsieur Fresnay soon realized he couldn't prevent political parties from being represented on the CNR. He couldn't get Milan fired. He couldn't place himself in opposition to de Gaulle. And he couldn't secretly be on the take from D.C. So he focused on the one target within range. As he put it, Milan presented us with the same options as the Germans, capitulate or resist. End quote. Oh, won't someone rid me of this troublesome priest? When Henry II said this in 1190, it was both a hint and a command. It resulted in four knights killing Thomas Becket at the altar of Canterbury Cathedral. In the touch-and-go times of the resistance, however, you didn't need four men and some horses to take out your enemies. That's what the Gestapo is for. No one has ever said Fresnay was out to kill Jean Milan, except Milan himself. As he put it in a report to London, "I am being sought simultaneously by Vichy and the Gestapo, and partly thanks to certain elements in the resistance, they are well aware of my identity. I have decided to hold on as long as possible, but if I disappear, I will not have had time to brief my successors." This report was one of many requests he made to train someone to replace him when the axe inevitably fell. It was a reasonable plea, but the very thought of it spooked London. A replacement for the man who had personally knit together the disparate factions? Whose mind was the living CPU of the resistance? The idea was met with fingers lodged firmly in ears, and a rousing chorus of "la la la, can't hear you." In a later note sent to de Gaulle, he writes, "Our very own war is hard." He goes on to describe the arrest of a general, the Secret Army. Quote, "The causes? First, there was the campaign waged against him and against myself by Fresnay, which has literally taken the conflict into the public arena." His statements about this environment are backed up by the assessment made by a Frenchman from London who was sent to visit resistance groups in the South and report back. He informed London he was shocked by the violent tone and condemnatory statements of Fresnay against Milan. An SOE report from the time concluded, The grave issues at stake and the dangers that the resistance workers were running forms a sad contrast with the bickering and intrigues between the leaders of movements. The report goes on to say Freinet was perhaps the chief offender. Okay, you may want to break out some grid-lined paper and diagram what happens next. Having a grasp on it will help you understand a lot of the controversies still surrounding the resistance today. Barely a month after the creation of the CNR, with political parties, thank you very much, a combat man named René Hardy was invited by another combat man, Aubrey, to a meeting of top resistance staff. Hardy hadn't been invited. Aubrey was pulling him in at the behest of one of combat's top men, Pierre de Benneville. Benneville later claimed he wanted to make sure combat had a strong voice at this meeting, a meeting to appoint a replacement for the general whose capture had resulted in Moulin sending that infamous message to London about Freinet taking his disagreements to the streets. It was also a meeting neither Henri Freinet nor Benneville himself planned to attend. The drop-in happened despite the fact the meeting was supposed to be under the tightest possible security. Few knew where it would be, and they were instructed to mention it only when necessary and to never write it down. They couldn't even write the name of the Lyon suburb in which it would take place. Calais. According to biographer Alan Clinton, Benneville's account of whether or not he knew Hardy had recently been arrested by the Gestapo fluctuated for years. But he recently admitted that, yes, he knew full well Hardy had been arrested and had even talked about it with Henri Freinet before Freinet left for London. René Hardy had been burned. Not long ago, a friend of mine was telling me about a coworker she doesn't trust. Her exact words were, "I avoid him like a man who just walked out of 84 Avenue Foch with no bruises." 84 Avenue Foch was the Gestapo headquarters in Paris. This tells you two things. One, she and I are dorks. And two, someone who strolls out of Gestapo captivity without a mark on them is considered toxic. Rules dictated that even if you are absolutely convinced they bought your cover story, you are under orders to sit out the game for a while to ensure you aren't being tracked. You go to ground. In Hardy's case, he was being tracked. According to some, he was even introduced to his tale by a Gestapo agent who called Hardy a Frenchman who has seen the light. The Gestapo then raided the meeting at Calais, arresting all the resistance save Hardy, who managed to run away when the Gestapo claimed to have not brought enough handcuffs. That's the story anyway, your mileage may vary. What is more than a story is that a top combat man sent a burned agent to a meeting of the highest resistance leadership, and that during Hardy's first trial for treason, when he claimed to have never been arrested in the first place, both Benneville and Freinet gave sworn testimony in his defense. Sworn testimony, Benneville later admitted, was false. Just what happened at Calais has been discussed and debated endlessly, as it still is today. One question that I don't think has been asked enough is, I know we love combat, I do too, but what role did top-level combat insubordination play in what happened? Hardy had been arrested, then sent to a meeting Moulin would attend. Sent by the very combat leaders that despised him and had no intention of attending themselves. As you may already know, Moulin was tortured for information by a man who appears to have been scraped from the bottom of humanity's barrel, and that's adjusting for Gestapo standards. Klaus Barbie is known as the Butcher of Lyon, and has been the focus of a lot of documentaries and books and articles, all of which I think he enjoyed, so I'm not going to go into it here. As Moulin's first biographer, his sister Laurie, put it, Moulin's death came, quote, at the limits of human suffering, without revealing a single secret, and he knew them all. As for Monsieur Aubrey, who was asked to take a known burned agent to a top-level meeting, known, that is, by the people who asked it of him, not by Aubrey himself, it must be said, he was tortured as well. He was sentenced to death, but escaped. He later fought with the Maquis for the rest of the war. He never associated with combat again. And what of Monsieur Freinet? He joined de Gaulle in Algiers, where he worked as Minister of Prisoners, Refugees, and Deportes. After the war, he left politics and worked in a toy company. He might have even managed it. Information about Monsieur Freinet after the war is hard to find. I know because I've been looking. What we do know is that he lived until 1988, and for the rest of his life, lived in a France that decided it liked his former boss very much. Monsieur Moulin's remains are kept in the Pantheon, the crypt reserved for France's most glorious dead. He, Victor Hugo, Jean Jaret, the Curies, all rest under a former church covered with murals of Joan of Arc. The lights of the City of Lights were extinguished when his ashes were transferred there. At the moment of their reinterment, a beam of light shot out from the crypt so strong it lit the city. By 1993, the number of streets, bridges, and squares named for him neared 1,000. Revenge is a dish best served every day for 45 years. It was the smack back that just kept giving. The problem is, if the betrayal at Calur wasn't a direct order, a pretty big if, but still, I don't think Mr. Moulin would be particularly vengeful. He had a style, and this wasn't it. When he heard about some of the problems Frenet was making for him with de Gaulle, he wrote a note to London outlining Frenet's own arguments. He expressed his belief that, while he thought Mr. Frenet's concerns were being addressed as best they could, he understood the gentleman's frustration. He lived for his work, he lived for his team, and he was frustrated when he felt their needs weren't being met. Now who did I just describe? Of course, both of them. At the end of the day, they would be capable of having a conversation with each other that only a handful of other people in the world could possibly take part in. I've said a lot of things today that make Henri Frenet sound vitriolic and perhaps even treasonous, so here's something straight from the man himself, from a letter he wrote after the war. I have renounced all active political life. My experience has taught me that the rules of the political game exclude any possibility of friendship between men. Rather than lose my friends, I prefer to abstain. For me, friendship is the essence of existence. Let me also share one more quote with you, from that Declaration of Resistance written so many years ago. Our struggle is by no means over. It is first and foremost the struggle of the human spirit against barbarism. In the end, there are two unambiguous things I believe about Henri Frenet. He should have been investigated for treason, and he receives nowhere near enough respect. Perhaps his final legacy is that exposure to his story makes us all a bit more like him, liable to spout contradictory truths in rapid succession. As for his relationship with Mr. Moulin, I leave you with this image by Ezra Pound. When, and whenever death closes our eyelids, moving naked over Acheron upon one raft, victor and conquered together, Marius and Jugurtha together, one tangle of shadows. Thank you all for listening and for your patience between episodes. Until next time, vive la Resistance.